business, like Netflix or Amazon Prime. Businesses where once a customer engages with them, it becomes automatic and a part of their lifestyle from then on. But how do you build that forever transaction? I'm Robbie Kelman-Baxter, and I have been studying subscription and membership models for nearly 20 years. In this podcast, my guests and I share the secrets and strategies of the membership economy. Join us for Subscription Stories, True Tales from the Trenches.
Many subscription entrepreneurs lament their lack of fancy software and dashboards to allow them to better manage their business. But if you know your ideal member and understand their pain points, and if you're always tinkering and adjusting your offering to better align with the needs of those members, you can build a powerful recurring revenue business, even as a solopreneur. This week's guest, James Schramko, has developed a unique model to help consultants and experts earn more while working less. And while he has been an early adopter of technology, many of the tools and tactics are flexible enough to be used by large or even very small businesses. More importantly, James has succeeded in building his subscription-based business by focusing on his members and their desired outcomes. Ultimately, membership is about trust and relationships, and James is an expert in both. In today's conversation, you'll learn why bundling too much into your subscription can cost you members, how to use technology to support a global community, and why a tiered ascension model sometimes leaves money on the table. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's so good to catch up again, Robbie.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. I really was so pleased and honored to be invited on your show. And I've been hoping to get you here for quite some time and just delighted to get into some details on your vast experience with subscriptions and with membership models. So let's jump in. I wanted to start with the current membership coaching model that you have for consultants and for experts. If you could just walk us through what that model looks like today.
So I guess in the middle of it, and I've always used my sort of membership model as being in the middle of my whole landscape. And I'd started doing that from about 2009. I called it a mafia plan. But in the middle is a $1,000 per month mentor program. And that has people who I'm helping with their online business in a really simplified consulting style of membership. And the way that's set up is they only get three things, which it's taken me a long time to take all the other stuff out, but they get weekly group call with me and a small group of the other people in that program. It's split over different time zones, so it doesn't matter where they are in the world. They get private chat with me, which is async, and it's in any modality they can do text, voice, or video. And the other thing they get is playbooks, which is where I took all my old trainings and all my knowledge and IP sheets and turn them into very simple checklists or frameworks. That's it. They're the only three things they get. And they can access that via a web or via a phone app. That's at the core. Downstream from that is a broader group on a lower price point. That's a $99 per month price point. There's a whole bunch of people in there. They actually get more things and less things. So they don't get the private one-to-one back and forth. They do get a group call, but that's once a month. That's recorded and they get all the previous recordings and they get each other in a forum. So that's really the classic old school forum, which is where I started with this sort of stuff back in about 2009. And they like that at their level. And then above the mentor group, there's two little levels. There's a private coaching group, and that's where people will get on a call with me every 2 weeks or so for half an hour or an hour. And we do old school one-to-one, and they can still come to group calls or get the playbooks. But it turns out they really mostly just want to talk to me or vent or share or upload, download, whatever they need to do. And then above this, and this has really been the holy grail for me, and I've been developing it for 8 years now, is a partnership program. And that's where I have a royalty model. So it's performance-based. I get paid a percentage of revenue, and to help my partner, I'll do whatever is required in the mix, whether it's calls with them, whether it's promoting their products on my podcast. introducing them to contacts or networks. But that is like the ultimate forever deal. It's like, hey, I want to go into this business, but I'm not going to set up in competition with you. Let's partner with it. And I'll just quietly sit in the background and guide you and help you. And you can keep all the brand and the accolades and stuff. I'll just help you out and get a small percentage. And I started that business. I learned that business model from my grandfather when I was about 18 years old. He was a timber broker and he was collecting 3% commission on timber deals. But I do like that model. And here's the interesting thing. I've got 8 partners now and they contribute more than half my income. And so it's a really strong business model. And the top few of those, if I only had 1 or 2 partners, that would actually be enough to fuel my lifestyle. In fact, 1 would fuel my lifestyle at this point.
Wow, it's great. So the role of the middle option, the membership, how do you think about that? Is that the point of entry? Do people come in at the lower level and take their time to work their way up? Or are there different kinds of people interacting with you in each of those levels?
Yeah, it's such a great question because we hear a lot about ascension model online and I'm not a huge fan. And my own data doesn't support the classical ascension model. I can give you some examples, right? If I'm a car buyer and I want to change brands, I'm not going to go and start off with a bicycle and work my way up to the lowest model in the range and then go up to the model that's suitable for me. I'm just going to go straight in and get the model that's suitable for me. So the 2 things that I'm sort of against, this idea that you put people in the little stuff and work their way up, because what is shown in my stats is the people in the middle program, at least 2/3 of them and probably even 3/4 of them come straight into that program. They didn't work their way up from the lower rungs. And there's a lot of people in my lower rung program who will never be in the higher level program because it's not the right program for them. It's like, if you don't drink alcohol and you go to a bar, you're going to order a Coke Zero. There's no way in that ever you're going to be ordering a vodka. So that's just not your product. The other thing that I think is overcooked in the online space is this whole hyper niching stuff and avatars. I have such an eclectic group of people in my program that you would never be able to pinpoint as a theoretical avatar. They're just so different. I've got young, old men, women. I've got all different races, all different business models, but they do have some things in common. They do want help ongoing. They do feel that I'm the person that has the experience to help them with it. And the longer that I'm in this, the more use cases and data sets I've been exposed to be able to help these people quickly and efficiently. So people can have quick wins. They come in and within a week, they're already starting to get a return on investment because I know exactly what levers to pull. So it'd be risky for me to just target a certain type of industry or a certain type of psychographic or demographic. And so they're the 2 oversimplifications that I think trap people, the ascension model and avatar niching. So I've always been a little broader. And I feel like our role as a marketer is to help people find the exact right product straight out of the gate. And I brought this from working with Mercedes-Benz in the car dealership. If someone walks into the showroom, I have to quickly find out what's important to them and then eliminate the other 120 models that I could suggest to them to get them to the exact right perfect combination as quickly as possible. Actually, one of the greatest salesperson that I had, he used to work in a retail suit store, and he said that his boss trained him when a customer walks in, he had to guess within 1 or 2 sizes the right size jacket to put on the customer, or that customer's going to lose interest and leave. So I believe our role is to find the perfect product as quickly as possible and eliminate all the distractions. And that's why for a long time I used a chooser on my website to help people find the right product and then only present the right product. And I think that's a good strategy. Rather than start everyone at the bottom and work their way up, which is going to annoy people who really need the higher level program.
Right. So if you met somebody, let's say on a plane, and they said to you, I have deep expertise in this area. I've been working for 20 years for a big company. I'm launching out on my own, looking to build a strong brand. Would you be able to tell quickly if he'd make a good client for you, a good member? And if so, which product would probably be right by asking a few questions or by having an informal conversation?
I would actually. I mean, almost always that person would be excluded from working with me on the basis that they're unproven, untested, and haven't started in the subscription model yet, because I only work with winners, which sounds harsh, but it's just such an easy business model. Something my mentor taught me is you can't steer a parked car. And what I've found is there's a lot of unknowns. If you see a car on the side of the road and you want to, and you think it's a great bargain, but you don't know if it's even got an engine or if it runs or it's unregistered, there's a lot of things to get past versus something that's already in motion. But that being said, I have helped corporate people adjust to their own business. So example, one of my partners, one of my royalty partners, I met him in the surf, and it was during COVID, and he was surfing pretty much every day out there. And then one day he said, I've been called back into the office. And I said, okay. He goes, I don't want to go back in. And I said, why go back in? He goes, well, what else would I do? And I said, well, what do you do? He said, I install $100 million banking systems for the bank. I deal with developers all around the world, 60 or 70 people. We manage these huge projects and deliver them with pinpoint accuracy. I said, that's a fantastic skill. It's exactly what my clients need, because they are highly creative visionaries. They are usually hopeless at managing people and systems. They're great at selling. They've got the best ideas, but they just get frustrated because they can never implement. I said, I want you to go and read Rocket Fuel by Gino Wickman. And then we're going to set up an agency where you're going to be the integrator to help my visionary clients. And he said, okay. And we set it up. Within a year, we're doing $500,000 a year. And I just hook him up to my visionary clients. And we had to go through this adjustment phase from him being an employee to him being an operator of a business. That is a huge leap that not everyone's prepared for. And so there's a lot of mindset things that go into that, a lot of unwriting of the rules of corporate, relearning about ultimate responsibility, and also getting punched in the face metaphorically in your business on a frequent basis, the things that happen. If your team member leaves and poaches your clients, or you scale too quickly and then your quality drops, or you go through a sort of a dry patch during the Christmas New Year break when all the corporates like stop buying, reassess their budgets and all that sort of stuff. So it's something that I do on a very small basis. But in that case, I chose the partnership model, the highest level of model, because it was such a strong need for my audience. And I had so much confidence in this person's ability to deliver. And he's amazing. And my clients have the best feedback. And he's so grateful for this. It's just a business from thin air. And it's amazing we can do that, but it would be rare. So if the person on the plane had that level of ability, I'd want to get to know them first, because I do have some rules and filters when I'm going to go into partnership with someone. At least in this case, I'd observe this guy for a year or two and had a good sort of understanding of his character and personality.
It's a great story. It's an outlier, but I love that you can recognize the kind of people that you can work with and that you can help the most. I think that that's really important, whether you're doing it at scale or whether you're doing it member by member. You need to be able to recognize them in the wild and say, that's a person or that's an organization that is going on the journey that I can accompany them on and guide them on.
Another aspect to that too, and that is that I've usually been good at picking where the demand is and where the industry is growing. I sold my SEO business, for example, which was a fantastic subscription business. We were doing six figures a month in sales. It was a great business. I had it for 7 years. But I felt like SEO was coming to some more choppy waters. And I feel like with AI, that's been an interesting one for the SEO industry. But for this guy, I really recognize there is a lot of people coming online who have expertise, especially since COVID. And I recognize within my own portfolio, this is a common problem that even though I can solve it with playlists and I can solve it talking to somebody, but then when they go away, they don't implement. I needed a service to implement and I didn't want to build the service. So it's like the perfect piece to the puzzle. And it made a lot of sense. Since then, I've done this again with someone with a startup in another service that I see is such a growth thing. And the one thing that I'll look at if I'm going to go into service provision or partnership is this a growing or a shrinking market segment? And that was just green fields. I mean, there's only a couple of people doing this. Fractional integration is still a brand new service, really.
Yeah. I wanted to circle back to something that you said at the beginning. You said, I asked you about your membership model and where it is today. And you said, you described it, but you said it's much pared down from where you started. I have found that many subscription businesses, when they start, they basically throw in everything but the kitchen sink, saying, if I have it, I'll add it to the bundle. And if the person doesn't need it, they just won't use it. Can you walk us through how you, where you started and how you pared it down and what, if anything, you're using as a guide to say, these are the three features I need to deliver and everything else is extraneous?
It's such an art. I mean, if we were to talk about a metaphor, we're looking for that statue of David from the block of marble, right? The risk of having things that your members don't value or use in your membership is they will use that as a reason to cancel. The classic, oh, I'm not using it. I learned this because in the early days of my membership, I had a couple of very enthusiastic members and they were starting to feed off my flock and they were starting to provide little services that were niche down services that were suitable for my audience because I'd gone out and spoken on platforms. I'd built my podcast. I'd brought these clients in and I could see these wolves were sort of coming in and starting to eat my sheep. And so to protect against that, I set up a weekly call where we would cover the same sort of topics that these wolves were trying to lure my sheep away with. And an interesting thing happened. After about 7 or 8 weeks, I was starting to get some people starting to cancel. And it didn't make sense because I'm offering more value, more stuff. And the reason given was I just can't keep up with the calls. I'm not using it. I'm not getting my value because it's, you know, there's all this stuff, but I can't get to it. And it's like, wow, that's really interesting. And so I switched it to monthly ever since. And that's been going on now, I don't know, for another 9 years or so, 10 years. And that is the right frequency for that level. So that was an interesting one. The way that I find out what people need or not is I look at the stats. Don't ask people. I think that's a terrible mistake because they don't even know and they'll probably just tell you whatever they think. What I do is I log in and look at what's being used. A classic example, in my $1,000 mentor level, I used to have a chat room for people in that level. But when I log in a month or two later and there's no chats and people aren't using it, it's clear to me that that's not useful or valuable to them. So I just delete it. And then I wait for someone to ask, where is that thing? And it hasn't actually happened yet. It's the same in the old days of my membership. I used to do a tour of the membership once a week. I'd go around the membership with a screen share video and I'd make a video of the highlights of the week and what's been going on and stuff. And then I'd send out that, edit the video. I'd upload the video. I'd put the embed on the video. I'd craft an email about the video. I'd send it out to the database and I'd get a 65 or 70% open rate and a whole bunch of people would watch it, but not much interaction with it. And then one week I just thought, maybe I'm just overdoing this. So I stopped doing it. And that was about 12 years ago. And I still haven't had anyone ask where that video is or what happened to it, right? So, and part of it is when I did my book, which I published about 6 years ago, one of the chapters was called 64-4. And that was exploring what happens if you 80-20 the 80-20. And the bottom line is that 2/3 of your outcomes are coming from 4% of your input. So it made me ask the question of all the things that I'm offering, where's the 96% that isn't really that important, right? It's almost everything. Now, just to prove a point, because I've been in the membership space for a while and I used to have people stalling, like they're creating all this Frankenstein behind, they've got to do all this stuff before they launch, before they open. And I thought, what would happen if I started a membership with zero content? And so I started a brand new membership. And I put on a new domain name and I started with zero content. It only had one feature. And the one feature was a chat wall, like a Facebook wall. And the promise was you ask a question, you'll get an answer within 24 hours. And I actually built up hundreds of subscribers for that membership. And so when it opened, it had nothing in it. There was absolutely nothing. There was not one question. It was just the instructions on what to do. And that was a very sticky membership and a really popular membership. And it was such a great experiment for me. So I say to people, if you're going to open up a membership, it's better to probably just have a waiting list and maybe ask a question or two, like what features do you think would be critical or what things, what problems are you having right now that you would like to solve? And then you decide what minimum features you want to put into it. And the more that I work with people in the software industry, the more I discover how critical it is to not have that scope creep, to not have feature creep, or to ruin a good thing. Plenty of good software got ruined by adding in too many things, and then it mutates the whole purpose of the thing. There's a lot to be said for Sputnik simple.
Yeah, amen to that. I think you brought up the point of people will cancel when you have too many features because of subscription guilt, right? I'm paying and I'm not using, and that makes me feel bad about myself. So instead of saying using one or two features a month is all I need and justifies the expense, I'm just going to cancel. And this is, I think this is the New Yorker problem. Like people say, oh, it's a great magazine, but I'm not reading every single article, so I'm going to cancel. Or worked with Produce Box, right, where they delivered a box of a variety of fruits and vegetables. And people were canceling because they don't like kale, right? And they'd look in the box and they'd see the kale. And even though it was such a great value, they felt bad. It reminded them that they were picky eaters.
And probably their parents drummed into them. Finish everything on the plate. There's a kid, starving kid in Africa.
Send them the kale. But what they did, which I thought was so clever, is number one, they changed their messaging. So they said, even if you only eat 2/3 of your box, you're getting way more value than you would get with the same spend at Whole Foods. You're keeping a local farmer in business. You're organic. You're putting fruits and vegetables in front of your family. And if it's there, they'll eat it. All these other great ways of thinking about it. And then they had a bag in the bottom that said, hey, anything that you're not using, put in this bag. And it said, give to a friend. It was like a pretty little bag. And I thought that was a very clever way of doing it. But even more than that, making sure that every feature you have either is what it takes to get someone to sign up, it's the acquisition benefit, or it's what it takes to keep them. And as you've pointed out, community and relationship, in your case, in your business, the relationship with you, the direct human relationship, that's what people are willing to pay for. And everything else is either going to make them feel guilty, or even worse, if it's a lousy feature, if it's out of date, if it's not being maintained well, if it's not completely on target, if somebody uses that as an early feature that they experiment with and it's not that good, they're not going to stick around. And so I love your discipline of keeping the product thin and focused. And I also love this emphasis on community and relationships, which I think people undervalue. Tell me if you agree or disagree. I feel like I'm a content creator. I create tons of articles and I've written books like you have, and obviously the podcast, but ultimately it's about the relationship. It's about the connection with me. It's about the connection with other subscription pros. It seems like that's something you discovered quite early on in building your own community. Where did that come from, or how did you notice that that's what was working?
Well, it probably came from my mother taking us around to schools when we were kids and stuff. Like, we used to visit foster homes or Aboriginal communities in the country. So she was pretty interested in making sure that we had cultural awareness and to understand social. It's funny because my 5-year-old daughter is very social. She's basically got the baton from my mom, I think. But also beyond that, when I went into the sales world, for quite some time in my life, I was responsible for a showroom, and we had customers walking in the door every day, complete strangers, and we had to quickly build rapport and understand their problems and solve them for them. And so I just had a high exposure into human communication. We had experts train us on communication. We did all sorts of courses, from recruitment to train the trainer to sales, negotiations, marketing. So just a really heavy exposure into personal communications. I mean, when I was a debt collector, I used to have to phone 100 people a day asking them to pay their bills. I've spoken to more people than most people will ever speak to in their entire life, probably by the time I was 30 years old. So just a high exposure. And when I was at the peak of my sales career at Mercedes-Benz, I was the one they would send to deal with celebrities and superstars and heavy hitters, because I had really good communication ability. I would deal with Russell Crowe or our prime minister or billionaire families and sports stars, because they knew I could handle it. And it was such a privilege to be put in that responsible position, but I also had to make sure things went smoothly. And we're talking about big transactions and delicate deals. So I knew that humans made the difference. The other thing that always fascinated me in a sales team, where you could have multiple people with the same resource, So let's say in a showroom, there's in my first sales job when I was 23, and there was six salespeople, and they had the same sales manager, the same stock to sell in the same physical location, and pretty much the same catchment of customers. But I could regularly outsell the other five. And it just blew my mind that with the same resources, some people just do a lot more and some people do a lot less. It's that unequal distribution that fascinated me. And so I realized that the human factor is a very important thing. And over the last few years, Robbie, I rebranded my business into a personal brand because I feel like that's the strongest moat that I can have. I'm the only me. And that is still in a world of robot and AI and synthetic and authenticity. That is such a strong draw card. The person is going to be probably even stronger in the next few years.
So I know that most of your members are small business owners, entrepreneurs, solopreneurs. Some of my listeners fit into that profile, but a lot of them are executives in larger organizations or are venture-backed entrepreneurs that are really, that have financial partners, which gives them less autonomy and kind of a different set of goals and objectives. And I'm wondering, I'm listening to you talking about your, I don't want to call it charisma, but your skills at building relationships, both in person and at scale. And I'm wondering to what extent your principles apply to my broader audience. Are there any skills?
Everybody. I mean, it's all the same skill set. The way that I worked my way through my career was understanding what people need and making sure I delivered on it. It wouldn't matter if you're servicing a grocery checkout store till, if there were five operators, you could be the best operator. You have a great relationship with the level above you. I'd always encourage that. And there was a very interesting time in my career where I'd reached the zenith of selling. I came first in Australia for selling Mercedes-Benz. And I was promoted to sales manager, and I came first in Australia as a sales manager. And I'm only saying this for context. I don't want to sound like a wanker. But in that role, I'd sort of maxed out where I could get to in that tier. And the next logical step was to run a dealership. And Mercedes-Benz selected me to go to dealer principal training. And I went to these very high-end camps where we got trained by the best. It was like Navy SEAL type level training. Another operator in the network who had noticed me, and we used to have some conversations, but there were a couple of incidents that happened that showed my character to him. One was I'd put together a deal of a multi-deal. It was two CL600s and like 17 ML320s, I think they were back then. It was like millions of dollars worth of deals. I'd sold this multi-million dollar deal. And on the day that the customer was coming to pick the cars up, one of the people detailing the car smashed it into a pole and it ruined the bumper bar. And this entrepreneur who was around the corner with a Mercedes-Benz authorized repair shop, I called him up and I said, someone's just ruined the car. Can I bring it around and see what you can do? And I brought it around. And I said, the customer's coming in about 30 minutes from now. And they pulled this bumper bar off a shelf and they, like a Formula One pit stop, I put it on. And then I drove back around. I said, I'll sort out your invoice later. And he was really impressed with how calm I was under the pressure and how I wasn't rude or demanding or any of that stuff. And then later he came over, he said, my guys, because he had a dealership as well. He said, my guys just can't sell this car that I've got. Can I give you guys a shot at it? I said, bring it over. And so they brought it over and we put it up on the showroom floor. And then the next day he came in and he said, I thought that car should have been here by now. I said, oh, it was, it's here. He goes, where is it? I said, it's out in the back. He goes, why is it out the back? I said, because we sold it. It's just getting prepared for delivery. He's like, what? He said, my guys haven't been able to sell that car for 6 months. And anyway, eventually this guy offered me a job to run his dealership. And he said, the reason I'm hiring you is because you have integrity. And it turns out in the car industry, integrity is really a valued commodity. But I'd say that's for any person anywhere in any role. If you're in any role, no matter what level, have good values and make sure that you're serving the needs of the people above you. Always be polite, even when you don't have to be. I mean, we've all worked for crazy bosses and maniacs and bad operators, but doesn't mean we should pass the baton. Like bad parents raising kids with bad parenting who then in turn become bad parents. Break the mold. Be so different that people want to deal with you, or they want to be involved with you. And that, I think, is, it's a tremendous asset. It's really hard to earn for a long time and keep. But I would say at this point in my career, just being the number one valuable asset, doesn't matter where people go to a conference in our industry or whatever, there'll be someone there who I've worked with or coached or helped in some way or had on my podcast. I've just kept at it for the longest time. But also it means saying no to cheap tricks, crazy bullshit tactics that often happen, especially in corporate. I know all the tricks that happen in corporate. You're driving home at the end of the month and they call you and they say, listen, we're going to have to count some of the next month's numbers into this month. And I'm saying, why would you do that? They say, oh, we have to report off to Germany and the numbers haven't been right and we need to get it looking good on the books for them. Basically, fraud happens in every company at every level unless you say, no, I'm not accepting that. And I saw how manipulated things can be in corporate. I then saw how it can happen in politics and governments during a pandemic. And I've always stood against that. And stand for something, have your values, and then you'll actually surround yourself with the right people. And that's why I've actually got the lower level tier of my membership now, which I really shouldn't have and don't need. But there are people that have been there for 8, 9, 10 years that want to be there. And I guess I don't want to close it on them.
Yeah, it is, especially I think in a membership business, in any business, relationships are important. But I think in membership businesses, subscription businesses, businesses where you're counting on recurring revenue and an ongoing relationship, your values and your ethics are really at the core. I'm curious, since you worked in the car industry for a long time, what you think about the subscription activities in the automotive space. So the heated seats with BMW, autonomous driving with Tesla, some of the security measures. Do you think that there's a future there? Are they going to figure it out? What would be your prediction on that?
I don't think there's a future in Tesla. So that might be counterintuitive, but I think, unfortunately, I think we're sliding into a world where we will not be allowed to own a car or drive a car at some point in the future. I think we're in the last glory days of having whatever vehicle we want and being able to drive it. I think in the UK right now, they're regulating from July onwards speed limits or electronic speed limitation. There's a lot of trouble with autonomous driving for Tesla right now with people dying because they're just letting go of responsibility. It's kind of like they're willing the future through being stupid. Not a huge fan of it. I mean, already a lot of people lease their cars. Like even if you went wound the clock back 20 years, it was fascinating to me how many people finance a car and how often the car is out of equity by the time it comes to trade in. So already people, especially the North American market, it's always been a pay by the month market. It's always been a subscription thing, really, if you think about finance. So it makes sense that it's all going to be incorporated or rolled up and then it'll be regulated. And then eventually you'd just be lucky if you can have access to a vehicle and you'll be paying a subscription. And if your credit score is not good because the social media scoring system marks you down like that nosedive episode of Black Mirror, then you won't have access to a vehicle. I hope it doesn't go that way. I'm more for the camp of independence. And as a consumer, that's interesting, right? Because I've made a whole living off subscription income. Almost everything I sell is subscription income. As a consumer, I'll only pay subscriptions if there's value, but I really like the option to be able to just pay once if I don't think the value will be there ongoing. So I think where the gray line is, a lot of people are offering subscriptions for things that don't have forever value, and that's a bit naughty.
Bad actors is what the FTC here in the United States is calling them, right? Is the bad actors who trick and trap their subscribers, offering them more than they can deliver, making them think they're getting a great one-time deal, but not realizing that they actually signed up for a replenishment model. And then the dreaded hiding of the cancel button on the back end. So, you know, I am with you. I love subscriptions. I love the ability to pay as you go and pay for value. But I do think that the organizations have to be at a certain level of ethical high ground in order to justify that kind of, I mean, subscriptions are just a payment method. They're not by themselves a model. You earn the right to have a subscription by treating your customer like they're a member.
I'd love to address that particular point if it's possible. Early on with subscriptions, I mean, I was in the online crowd. They are the Wild West, right? And they ruin everything, hiding, not sending out billing reminders, hiding the fact that it is a subscription, all that Very, very bad stuff. I went the complete opposite way, especially after learning about that people canceling for not using. My choice is I want people to get the best possible value. So there's three things that I do that make sure of that, probably four or five. But one is I'm only getting the right people in the first place. So I don't do any tricky, hypey marketing stuff that gets the wrong people in. That just ruins a membership. You're increasing your chance of chargebacks. You're having dissatisfied customers. There's no point doing that. So only dealing with the right qualified people is very important. We do send billing reminders every month. And I only actually now bill monthly. On all my programs, I only bill monthly because I want to earn my seat.
You and Netflix are probably the only two subscriptions that only do monthly.
I know there's lots of reasons pro and against, and I did annual only for a long time as well for other reasons, but I'm 30 days away from retiring at any point in my life without any service beyond 30 days, and I quite like that. The two most important things, though, and this is very important, if you have a subscription, you don't have these, and you have something similar to me, and you put these in, it will change your life. One is, on the weekly group calls, we added an add to calendar button. It sounds so simple, but I had people joining and then not knowing how to get to the call or not coming to the calls. But once we had that add to calendar button and it populated their calendar with the calls, they show up. And if they show up, I can help them and then they get a return on investment and they never leave. That was one major, major retention strategy. The other one is the classic slipping away email reminder. If people stop engaging, I will hunt them down and ask them to come back. And I've got this email, Robbie, that comes out and it's got a 90% open rate and it has made me millions of dollars. And that's just making sure that people are going to engage with me, because I hate it when someone buys and then disappears. And then later, that gremlin can really grow. They could actually build up anger or resentment towards you for their lack of resourcefulness or forgetfulness if you're not careful. So I take that out of the equation. If they don't come after multiple follow-ups, I might even unsubscribe them.
Okay, I love that. I'm wondering if we can get that email.
I'll tell you what it is. So this is so simple that people would write it off as being too simple. But the subject line is, "You okay?" question mark. And then the body is something almost equally as simple. It's like, I'll just look it up for you, because I want to get this right. But this, it gets a very high open rate with that subject line, because it obviously speaks to someone very personally. Here's the body. It's first name, "How are you doing?" question mark. That's it. So it's like, "Robbie, how are you doing?" It kind of compels you to say, "Oh, sorry, yeah, look, I got busy recording five or six podcasts and I saw the meeting was on, but then I had to pick my kids up from school, but I'll be there next week." And like that's where, to the extent of how much they respect and value the personal relationship, they won't want to let me down because I don't want to let them down.
That's the whole thing?
That's it. That's the whole thing.
You okay, Robbie? How are you doing?
Yeah.
Awesome. I think that's really important. And I've been advising organizations for years to, the number one way that they can retain people is make sure they're getting value from the product and have some way of tracking when someone's disengaging. But your intervention is so elegant and so simple. It's total gold. And the calendar one, removing friction between the member and the value, it's just so easy. Those little operational things can make such a huge difference. I really appreciate that. I want to ask you, I'm an independent consultant. I've been doing this for a long time. What's one thing I could be doing to be more successful?
Looking back through your archive of clients and scoring them. So pull up a spreadsheet. Populate it with your clients down one column. And then across the top, you can put factors that might be interesting to you. Like, you could rate them out of 10 for revenue contribution, enjoyment working with, refers you to others, got a result. And you could find the high score clients and then zero in on them as the bullseye of your target board, and then develop a campaign to attract more of people just like them. And only work with them. And now you cut away the waste, and you would have learned from the, if you get a very low score, you'd want to know what caused that. How can you defend against that in your marketing offer? Who this is not for? That's why you asked me about the aeroplane scenario. I will exclude almost everybody from working with them unless they fit the perfect criteria, because if they fit the criteria, they are going to be so wildly successful that it's ridiculous. And I enjoy that the most.
Got it. Very helpful. Okay. We're past time, but I'm enjoying this so much. And I hope you'll come back because I have more questions. But to wrap up today, are you okay with a speed round?
Oh, yeah, I've got all day. I literally don't have any appointments today.
Awesome. First subscription you ever paid for?
Paid for? It would have been an email autoresponder.
Email autoresponder.
I mean, unless you're talking about telephone, because if it was telephone, yeah, I would say the telephone, my telephone service in the 90s would have been the first one.
Your favorite subscription that you use today outside of your own?
Oh, that's the Surf Forecast. That's a no-brainer.
Surf Forecast. Top tip for podcast interviewers?
Oh, gosh. Plan the structure of your show before you hit record. If you're just freewheeling, it could be very dangerous unless you have a super talented guest.
And final question. You sold, as you mentioned, Mercedes-Benz cars for many years, both stints at BMW and GM. What's your favorite thing to drive today?
I've got a Toyota Land Cruiser, twin turbo, six-cylinder that's tuned, and it's so impressive. They're actually the world's most profitable car company, and I really rate Toyota. And probably sounds pedestrian, but gee. And in Australia, they're sort of a cult following. You can buy it and then sell it again without losing much money at all. And they're just so fit for purpose.
Fascinating. James Sharamko, thank you so much for being a guest on Subscription Stories. It was a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Oh, enjoyed it a lot. Thanks, Robbie.
That was business mentor James Sharamko. For more about James, go to jamesschrempko.com. And for more about Subscription Stories, as well as a transcript of my conversation with James, go to robbiekelmanbaxter.com/podcast. Also, I have a favor to ask. If you like what you heard, please take a minute to go over to Apple Podcasts or Apple iTunes. Leave a review. Mention James in this episode if you especially enjoyed it. Reviews are how listeners find our podcast, and we appreciate each one. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening to Subscription Stories.